John Bachman, who pierces in people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, December 2nd, 2010. Today, two Palestinians were killed near the northern border of Gaza Strip by the Israeli army while, according to Israeli sources, were attempting to infiltrate in a kibbutz outside the strip. The Israeli military said that they saw a number of armed Palestinians trying to approach the border. Local sources stressed that Israeli troops launched a barrage of at least 15 artillery shells to them. Another Gazan boy was killed due to an electrical shock inside one of the tunnels in the Rafah district, the southern area of the strip. Also in Gaza, the prime minister of the deposed government, Ismail Haniyeh, stated that his government will accept the results of a public referendum on a peace deal with Israel as long as this referendum includes all Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza Strip and in exile. He added that Hamas would accept a state in the 1967 borders with Jerusalem as its capital if the referendum results say so, even if it contradicts the beliefs and the principles of the movement. The Israeli government approved on Wednesday evening the construction of additional 625 units in Pisgat Zif settlement in occupied East Jerusalem. Since the temporary settlement freeze expired on September 25th, Israeli settlers started the construction of more than 1,200 units in East Jerusalem settlements and additional 1,000 units in the West Bank. In addition, Israeli sources reported that the Israeli security forces have recently detained an Arab man from Al-Fritz Arab village north of the country, who is suspected to be collaborating with the Hamas movement and of committing security offensives. The prosecution at the Haifa District Court claims that he was recruited to the Hamas movement through the friend he met at the Islamic University in Hebron. That sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Husam Kasis and Ani Razaban.
Afghanistan, yesterday, NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier in an IED attack at an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan Wednesday. Afghanistan today, NATO is reporting the death of two occupation soldiers, one in an IED attack at an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan today, the other in an insurgent attack at an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan today. Afghanistan, Monday. Six U.S. soldiers were killed when an Afghan border police trainee suddenly turned and opened fire on U.S. troops. The Taliban claims he was one of theirs. Afghanistan, Tuesday. NATO reported the death of an occupation soldier from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday. A U.S. soldier killed a Taliban prisoner, quote, because they wanted to kill the bad guys, he told a military court on the 1st of December. Private First Class David Lawrence, 20, is facing a court-martial for shooting an alleged Taliban detainee who was sleeping in a prison cell. His attorney is blaming drugs prescribed for schizophrenia and depression. This raises an obvious question. Why are troops with these conditions being deployed to war zones? Canada, yesterday. In a shockingly flippant comment to a Canadian television news anchor, Tom Flanagan, a senior advisor and strategist to the Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, called for the assassination of WikiLeaks director Julian Assange. Baghdad, ongoing. Muqtada al-Sadr's Sadrist movement was the key block that assured Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's re-election, and now the fiercely anti-U.S. fundamentalist group wants its cut in return, a bigger role in Iraq's new government. This could mean trouble for U.S. occupation troops and their allies. Meanwhile, bombs still go off every day in Iraqi cities. Baghdad, 1st of December. Explosives experts evacuated a popular market in Baghdad on Wednesday after discovering a car bomb near it, according to a security source. Baghdad, 1st of December. A big bomb-making factory was found in the city. Surely there are many more like it. Baghdad, Tuesday morning, a bomb attached to a civilian car exploded in Al-Lika Square in western Baghdad, wounding three civilians, according to police. Tikrit, 1st of December, mortar rounds were fired at a U.S. fuel tanker east of the city. Visayas of Iraq, today, three mortar shells hit a U.S. base in the northern part of Hilla today, police source reported to Aswan al-Iraq news agency. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday, a U.S. Army patrol was attacked with an explosive charge blast east of Baghdad on Wednesday, according to an Iraqi security source reporting to Aswan al-Iraq news agency. Wait a minute, what U.S. patrol? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, does this sound like 8 years of war have done anything to guarantee security in Iraq? Does this really sound like a viable model for Afghanistan? If not, now is the time to throw in the towel, bring all the troops home today.
Thank you. town on a brick. Zainab Salbi grew up in Iraq and knows the effects of war firsthand. She co-founded Women for Women International in 1993 at the age of 23 to provide training for women living in conflict and post-conflict areas. The group offers women survivors of war, civil strife, and other conflicts with the tools and resources to move from crisis and poverty to stability and self-sufficiency, thereby promoting viable civil societies. Since its founding, Women for Women has raised $89 million for direct aid and microcredit loans to assist 270,000 women and 7 million family members. The group organizes a year-long aid program that provides rights education, job skills training, and small business development. Salbi is author of the book Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam, which tells the story of her life in Iraq and her flight to the U.S. where she now lives. Salbi spoke on November 18th at Yale University, where she discussed the discrimination and violence that women face around the world, as well as their accomplishments in keeping society running in times of war. What follows is an excerpt from her talk.
If you look at any crisis in the world, and you will see women are at the heart or are disproportionately impacted by that crisis. 2/3 of the most impoverished population in the world are women. 80% of the refugees in the world are women and children. 90% of modern war casualties are civilians, 75% of which are women and children. Women are 70% of the farmers in the world. They are producing 60% of the food in the world. They're earning 10% of the income and they own less than 2% of the land. If you want to look at the rates of HIV or illiteracy or whatever you want to look at it, whatever crisis in the world, you see women and girls are disproportionately impacted by the crisis. But when it comes to solutions, the solutions are, you see, women and girls are mostly on the marginal discussion. If you look at war as an example, we often discuss war from a frontline discussion. We often look at the army and the troops and the weapons and the military tactics and all of these things, and that's absolutely a very good way to look at war. This is one way of looking at war, and it's usually led by men. What we don't look actually is the backline discussion, which is how do you live in war? For some reason, and as someone who actually lived in war and now works in war, people forget, I'm surprised that people are always surprised to learn that people go to school in war and you have meals and you fall in love and you go to parties and go to weddings and get divorced and all the normal life happens within a war framework. But there is fighting, and in the TV you're only seeing the fighting. The backline discussion is usually led by women. They are literally keeping life going in the midst of war. Yet when we have peace agreements, it's usually about the frontline discussion. So it is about the ending of fighting as opposed to the building of peace, the backline discussion. And there is a way to include the two. We don't have to choose between women and men. There is a way to include the two, but no peace can be actually lasting and sustainable. And we were just talking earlier with someone here. Bosnia is a great example of a peace agreement that it was about the ending of fighting, not the building of peace, because you still actually have an instability in that country. So women in that way play a critical role. So rather than have women as a marginal discussion, you know, check all the ethnic minorities and gender minorities, check, we need to actually change it into the core of the discussion. There is no way we can talk about the building of sustainable societies, sustainable democracies, sustainable economies if we are not including women at the heart of the discussion. And this is not because I lead Women for Women or that I identify myself as a feminist or a strong woman, not at all. This is actually, at Women for Women, we argue there is no way we can have strong nations if we do not have strong women in it. So the core of the discussion is how do you change it? And rather than seeing them on the margin, we have to see women at the core of the discussion, both at the decision-making as well as the solutions. A Sudanese woman once told me, I was in southern Sudan, and I was interviewing a woman, and I said, what does peace mean for you? And she looked down at her feet for a second, and she's thinking, and she's like, peace means I have toenails. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And she said, well, for the 20 plus years of war in southern Sudan, I was kidnapped twice by the rebels and enslaved by them, which meant that I had to carry water and ammunition and food, and I was raped by them throughout the period of my enslavement. So I stopped. Every time I escaped, I'm afraid of staying in one place for more than 5 nights. So I walked for the whole 18 years that she said, I walked and I did not sleep in one place more than 5 nights at a time. And I lost my toenails. And since there was a signing of a peace agreement, which is very fragile right now, she said, since the signing of a peace agreement, I stayed in one place and my toenails grew back again. So peace means I have toenails. Unless we look at peace from a toenails perspective, we are missing out on something really major. And how do you build sustainable peace?
That was Zainab Salbi, co-founder and president of Women for Women International. Contact the group's Washington office by calling area code 202-737-7705 or visit their website at womenforwomen.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
On the 18th of November, D.C. officials held a public hearing on declaring Franklin School, home of the former Franklin Shelter for the Homeless, surplus, so it could be sold to a developer. It didn't go quite as they planned.
Council Chair Vince McGray, now Mayor-elect, wrote a letter to the mayor, Fenty, about the closure of the shelter, about his great concern about steps taken to reduce capacity and whatnot. And barring new admissions, on September 16th of 08, the council had hearings and passed the Franklin Shelter Closing Requirements Act of 2008. The mayor, we contend, has never complied with that. There are lawsuits now pending in court, and now in the Court of Appeals in the local court, as well as the federal court, about the legality of closing the shelter. So despite the fact that this act was passed, the mayor hurriedly closed it on September 26th of 2008. And I was there that morning. It was pouring rain. They threw the guys' stuff either in trucks or in garbage dumps. They threw the guys out in the rain. There were people with mental illness walking the streets crying all weekend. And they told them they had to go to Anacostia, okay? Since then, Lacoste has been closed. It was closed on October 15th. And there are people sleeping all over the world.
Be sure, because they're not listening when you care.
Ooh.
The very fact that all these people have come here and said that there is a need for a shelter, for a school, for a detox clinic, for a healthcare clinic, the list goes on, means by your very definition of surplus, it does not meet that. It means, for your definition of surplus, 10801 says there's no further public use. There's been a clearly defined public use. There's a very clearly defined public need. It's not surplus.
Not surprisingly, a wealthy suit-wearing yuppie from a condo building at 1155 K Street showed up to say he hated the homeless, he hated the shelter, and he was glad Franklin Shelter was closed and supported Mayor Fenney and Jack Evans. This is no surprise from some of these condo owners.
I own and live in a condominium at 1150 K Street Northwest. My wife and I moved from Northern Virginia to the district with the hope of improving our quality of life by taking part in the great urban renaissance that is sweeping America.
Now that's an interesting choice of words. Quality of life was what Rudy Giuliani used as his excuse in New York for arresting people in the most trifling of offenses, and was used in San Francisco to justify attempts to criminalize sitting or lying down on the sidewalk.
In regard to the Franklin School, we supported Mayor Fenty and Councilman Evans in closing the shelter.
So economic development is giving Donatelli $8.6 million in tax abatement because he couldn't make the George Avenue Petworth building's condos only apartments. Many of the people who lived in Franklin's shelter were working men.
That's right.
Not, they weren't drug addicts, and I resent the man who may live near there. He came from Virginia. We here in D.C. were already here when he got here.
Ooh.
And to smear men who lived in Franklin shelter as if the majority of them were drug dealers is ridiculous.
The economic argument goes, arguing that it costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 to $20 million for rent and building, and the city shouldn't do that. I'd like to ask them why the city spent $50 million as a gift to the Verizon Center to renovate their TV. So this is our money served also other purposes besides schools being turned over to developers, only for them to leave the buildings vacant for years. I've heard the complaint from some people, you know, that it's a problem for the buildings to be vacant, yet they've been turned over to private hands, and that happens as well. So I don't think the answer is, well, if the city is going to keep the building boarded up, you know, it should be turned over to private hands, because that's what's going to happen with private hands as well. If you take the Randall School, located at Half Street and I Street Southwest, it was turned over to the Corcoran Gallery of Art in 2004. It was serving as a men's shelter at the time. The city gave it to them for the third of the assessed value. It was assessed at $20 million. They gave it to them for $6.2 million.
I was part of the original Mayday DC crew that seized Franklin School back in 2002 and got it open as a shelter. My role was logistics, scouting, and intelligence. In 2003, when the shelter was closed at the request of the McDonald's that had newly been rebuilt at 13th and New York Avenue, we occupied the building again. The building was reopened. The Great Panthers bottom line, the occupation, they didn't dare arrest anybody. How can you guarantee to any potential buyer of this building that it doesn't get occupied again? We're still here. The need for housing is still here. A lot of people's lives were saved when Franklin became a shelter. People are dying in the streets now that the shelter is closed. So there is no way, shape, or form that this is a building with no public use, because people are dying since it's been empty. Lastly, if this building is turned into a luxury hotel, there is nothing anybody can say or do that would guarantee that somebody doesn't buy themselves a bag of bed bugs from a laboratory supplier, rent himself a cheap suit, or rent himself a room in a hotel. And then you got people outside with signs saying, I'm homeless. I used to sleep in this building. It used to be a homeless shelter. And guess what? It still got the bed bugs. Yeah, it didn't have bed bugs when it was a homeless shelter, but that don't mean it ain't going to have bed bugs when it's a luxury hotel. Mayday DC, we stood for action, not words. Direct action was the motto for dealing with this city's housing crisis. And based on what I'm seeing here, it looks like that's going to be necessary again.
Let Mr. Gray know that if you see them tear down, you know, going through this whole process of shoveling that dirt to tear down the Franklin School and turn it into a luxury hotel, that is going to be the beginning of the end of the administration of Vincent Gray. Thank you.
rich patients for his children in rags. Welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. The shopping mall just to pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich patient for his children and rags. Welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping mall just to pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. Once again, we have to wonder what the D.C. City Council has been smoking. Last week, the D.C. City Council took preliminary steps towards passing two bills to criminalize protests at the homes of corporate criminals. While the real reason for the law is union and homeless advocates protesting at the homes of the mayor and people like Councilmember Jack Evans, they are using animal rights activists as their excuse. The excuse given is a blizzard of animal rights protests at the home of a Goldman Sachs executive seeking to force Goldman Sachs to divest all their stock in an investment firm called Fortress. Fortress prevented the bankruptcy of an animal testing laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences with $100 million in loans. The executive in question is probably also responsible in person for the taxpayer-funded bailout of Goldman Sachs, but D.C. Councilmember Jack Evans and his friends take their orders from wealthy developers and other corporate criminals, not from the taxpayers. The strategy of passing laws against peaceful protests and going to court for injunctions against peaceful protests has been tried before with catastrophic results. In the late 1980s, religious extremists besieged women's health clinics with nasty but essentially non-violent protests against a woman's right to choose. Clinic defenders held the doors open, kept the clinics running through the worst of these protests, but outraged activists and physicians sought legislative relief. The result was the FACE Clinic Access Act, which made the nonviolent blockades of our clinics a felony early in the Clinton presidency. The result of the FACE law was a storm of brutal violence. While it was no longer necessary to wake up at 4:30 a.m. to fight and defeat Operation Rescue at the clinic gates, the FACE law made the penalties for those protests essentially the same as the legal penalties for heavy-duty vandalism, fires, even clinic bombings. The result was an unprecedented wave of clinic bombings and arson, and a string of shootings that forced doctors and clinic escorts to wear body armor. After all, this was no more illegal than the peaceful protests, which may have been a nuisance, but took no lives and destroyed no property. In 1996, buttons were seen, including at animal rights marches, that showed a target bullseye and said, "I'm pro-choice and I shoot back," a reference to the wave of murders that only recently culminated in the assassination of Dr. Killer in what can once again be called Bleeding Kansas. Jack Evans, Mayor Fenney, the rest of the council, do you really believe that in the light of these disastrous results,
that the clinic access laws were a viable model to repeat? If not, the Residential Tranquility Act and the rest of these efforts to sacrifice the First Amendment on the altar of corporate profits need to be voted down and never resurrected. Black Friday, the 26th of November 2010. The winter's fur wars kick off with Fur Free Friday as marchers gathered at the site of a victory. The former Andreana's Furs, round the corner from Neiman Marcus, also known as Neiman Carcass, is now closed. The space formerly occupied by Andreana's Furs is up for lease. Not satisfied with one victory, fur protesters moved on to march to the area's fur shops along Furriers Row, beginning by engaging Lord and Taylor, a notorious fur-selling department store.
Lord and Taylor, the fur on your back!
It's blood on your hand!
The fur on your back!
It's blood on your hand!
Yeah!
No more
tension,
no more
trust! No more fur on the contract!
No more
tension,
no more
trust! No more fur on the
contract! Protesters also showed up at Bloomingdale's before marching around the corner to Neiman Marcus on Wisconsin Avenue at the Maryland state line. For over 10 years, protesters have brought confrontations over fur to the door of Neiman Marcus. This year was no exception, with a showdown at the front doors that forced the store to lock them up.
Neiman Marcus is closed. We're on the largest shopping
mall in the world.
The largest shopping mall in the world. Neiman Marcus is closed.
Sounds like it hurts. After protesters got finished protesting this kind of torture at Neiman Marcus, they went up into Maryland to the infamous Christian Dior upscale boutique, where protesters have been harassed and wrongfully arrested for protesting fur in the past. Unlike previous protests in both Maryland and D.C., this time around, police went out of their way to avoid provoking protests with unlawful arrests or unlawful orders. And if that isn't enough for you, a couple of Native American protesters in the action had something to say to all those white folks who've been thankful on Thanksgiving for land stolen from Native American people.
And I'm sorry, Neiman Marcus, seeing how you don't care about these animals here, you probably gathered around some dinner table with your family or some other people, gathered up to celebrate turkey genocide day as well. But yesterday was more than just a turkey genocide day, Neiman Marcus. Yesterday, March as a month on October 12th, in 1492, when Columbus came over here, about 518 years of white supremacy and domination on these stolen lands.
At another point, this speaker made a very interesting point about how the Europeans who arrived in the Americas exploited Native American labor to feed their taste for furs in Europe. The same upscale, wealthy fur industry that continues to this very day at hellholes like Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale's, and Lord & Taylor.
2nd of December, both Japan's illegal whaling fleet and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society of Whale Wars fame left harbor, both found the whale sanctuary in the Southern Ocean off of Antarctica. Never before have the whalers reported this late. Always in the past, leaving port between November 6th and November 16th for the past 10 years in a row. Nishan Maru and her fleet of killer ships will arrive in their self-appointed whaling grounds at least 2 weeks late. Sea Shepherd will be there first. They have a self-appointed quota of over 900 whales, but last year Sea Shepherd kept them to less than half of that. The whalers sailed from Inoshima, Japan, the three-ship Sea Shepherd battle fleet from Hobart, Australia, weeks closer to Antarctica. Sea Shepherd has replaced the Adi Gil, sunk last year by the whaler security ship shown in Maru No. 2, with the Gojira, another fast interceptor, again a converted ocean racer, looking very much like the Adi Gil but larger. Captain Paul Watson says it is now a race against time to save the whales, but it sounds like time and sailing distance will now work in favor of Sea Shepherd, which enters the fight with at least 2 weeks already removed from the whalers' poaching season.
Mother Jones magazine reports right-wing Tea Party activists are now looking to halt smart growth initiatives in communities across suburban America, including plans to boost public transit to ease congested highways. Tea Party activists are using their clout in Republican circles to spread a conspiratorial view of the United Nations in local planning and zoning disputes. Their impact has been felt in decisions ranging from a septic tank inspection law in Florida to a plan to reduce traffic along Route 1 in coastal Maine. The focus of Tea Party fury is Agenda 21, the non-binding policy paper adopted by the 1991 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. The document sets broad outlines for sustainable development but has no enforcement power. For the Tea Party faithful, Agenda 21 is the genesis of all smart growth initiatives in suburban America and a direct attack on private property rights. Virginia Tea Party activist Donna Holt says Agenda 21 is a threat to the U.S. Constitution and the core values of suburban America, like the right to live in a single-family home. Holt is following the teachings of Henry Lamb, the founder of Sovereignty International, who for decades has theorized the UN covertly wants to herd millions of people into overcrowded cities and wall off the rest of the land into wildlife conservation areas. Thus far, Tea Party activists have succeeded in killing major initiatives to boost public transit and smart growth land use plans in some local communities across the United States.